Welcome back. This is Red Eyes Radio, and we are happy to have you with us today as we continue our investigations and peer into interesting topics that offer a different view and question the official history and version of events that we're told to believe. I'm Henrik Palmgren from Sweden at our websites redeyescreations.com, redeyesradio.net, and also redeyesmembers.com. We have a lot more for you. Well, today we have another one of those programs where we ask you to put your preconceived ideas to the side, you know, what you've been told from school to Hollywood, and of course instead make some room for some new perspectives and new thought. It is indeed a crowded and narrow area that we are going to go into today, and it's probably occupied by more predetermined conclusions than any other historical period. Well, I guess that could be argued as well. But it's interesting to hear about research from new angles that shine a light on those other sides that we seldom get an opportunity to hear. Veronica K. Clark specializes in World War II history and military history. She has two associate degrees, one of which is in diesel mechanics technology. She earned her bachelor's degree in 2005, her master's degree in 2009, and she completed 1 year of doctoral studies in organizational psychology in 2010. Veronica founded Vera Icona Publishers in 2011. She is the originator of both the Werewolves of the Iron Cross and Powerwolf publications series, as well as the author of the popular book Black Nazis. Her latest book, Werewolves of the Iron Cross, Black Wolf, White Reich, Volume 2, was released in 2014. And currently she's writing her first historical fictional novel. Well, Veronica has a lot of research behind her, and she has a lot of material to discuss, but we'll begin this program to tackle some of the most thrown around myths concerning the rise and fall of the National Socialist Workers' Party in Germany. Welcome, Veronica. We're very glad to have you here. Thank you for coming on the program. Hope you're doing well today.
Thank you for having me. Doing very well.
Excellent. Well, I heard some great interviews with you, and you have a lot of interesting books available on the topics that we're going to be addressing here today. And I really wanted to bring someone on as well who could speak about some of the many myths and, conspiracies really that are flying around in regards to the rise and fall of the National Socialist German Workers' Party, the NSDAP, or the Nazi Party, as people call them as well. And there certainly are a lot of things that can be addressed in terms of this topic. But, you know, before we get started on some of these points that we have here, Veronica, I wanted to ask you, I guess, more about some of the fundamental background to this and about your interest in the subject overall and why it is something that you've dedicated many years of research to, writing books about, speaking about. I mean, isn't it all this known already? And, I mean, what's the point in digging in such a nasty part of our history, right? What's been the driving force here for you?
You know, I can't really put my finger on what got me into this. Originally, I came across a website called NoBeliefs.com that argued that Hitler was a Christian. And back at that time when I first started, I myself was also Christian, though I had serious qualms with the Old Testament. I despised the sexism and misogyny in the Old Testament, and I felt that somehow it just didn't belong with the New Testament. That for some reason these two books were diametrically opposed and had perhaps been stuck together by some entity that had an interest in doing so. And what I found out through my study of Hitler's idea of Christianity, if you will, and the Nazi conception of Christianity was that they rejected what is called Pauline Christianity, or the idea that the two books do go together. And they purged all the Jewish references from it, and then basically reissued like a Nazi Bible, quote-unquote Nazi Bible, and I'm sure those are still out there. So what piqued my interest was, how could Hitler have been a Christian? And if this is in fact true, was there a legitimate basis, perhaps based in his Christian upbringing or worldview, that brought him to oppose Jewry? Because I knew from Catholics and Catholicism generally, which is what I grew up with, that they had serious qualms with Judaism as well, and just Jews generally. So that's really what got me into studying Hitler. And then from there, I started studying the Third Reich, and I realized that much of what we have been told is lies. And the works of a researcher named Antonio J. Munoz on the foreigners and ethnic minorities who served with the Germans and whom numbered in the millions just blew me away. And then also the work of Mr. Brian Mark Rigg, Hitler's Jewish Soldiers, wherein he discovered that as many as 150,000 Jewish and part Jewish individuals served in Hitler's armed forces. And I mean, I didn't know any of this coming into it. So it was absolutely astounding to me. And if it was astounding to me, it's going to be astounding to other people as well.
Well, certainly. And I mean, much of this points to a very different, reality of the history than we're being told. I feel that there's very much of a kind of a, a Hollywood invention to a large extent. And of course, some, historical biographies and whatnot, of course, played into this as well and whatnot. But it's very difficult, I feel, to just kind of get an objective view. And much of that is tainted by the very fact that people are not comfortable looking into it at all, which I feel is a huge shame, since it's such a tremendously it's such a pivotal point in our history, and so much have consequently changed. I feel that a lot of things, even today, despite if people understand that or not, but a lot of things today, hinges on what occurred during the Second World War and all that. And that's why I feel it's really important to try to have an objective view on this. Has that been part of your goal as well, Veronica, to try to like find out, okay, what really happened here and what was the reasoning behind it? Because those are extremely difficult questions, since there's just so much contradictory information out there available.
That's kind of become more what I'm interested in as I've progressed in my own development and my own research. Right now, I'm really focused on the whole racial aspect and the myths therein. But it is very important because, in my view and the view of many others, it was a linchpin moment in Western history, and our history has never been the same since that point. And it's almost like the Germans at that point in time were trying to form some kind of bridge between the technologized, progressive now and future and the past. And they were trying to hold on to some kind of European past and identity. And they might have been either before their time or behind the times. It's hard to say, because right now we're in such a bizarre catch-22 situation globally, with some people kind of going, maybe we're getting too fast. Maybe the world is just too technologized, too fast. We're losing jobs like crazy, because the more imagination and whatnot that we have, the fewer jobs we have. There's tens of millions of youth unemployed, etc. So really, when you start studying the NSDAP and its policies intensively, what you find is Himmler and his sort of peasant, return to the peasant and the land concept, the settling of the East, which was former German territory, Hitler's ideas about employing the masses, parking machines and employing people instead. It's almost like they were trying to, go into the future, but somehow mitigate the damage that industrialization, etc., had. So that's something I really appreciate about the National Socialist worldview and system. It was willing to somehow synthesize progressive and past. So that's one aspect that definitely I think we need to look closer at the National Socialist ideology, because there's answers there that we are seeking now. Europeans especially in light of all this immigration and whatnot, they had answers to the problems we have today that were workable solutions, and they weren't incredibly racist. They weren't genocidal. These are all lies to cover up the goodness there. You don't throw out the baby with the bathwater, kind of a thing. So we need to look at it again.
Interesting. Yeah, maybe we get the opportunity a little bit later to return to some of those kind of bigger questions here and tackle some of those points and the perception that people have. But I do want to try to get to some of the points we discussed beforehand here at Addressing First, and there really is kind of a checklist almost of some of the things that I wanted to try to kind of address, because there's so many of these kind of flying around there. It has to do, of course, with the rise of the National Socialists, the funding of them, etc. But let's begin with the Reichstag fire as a false flag operation to basically gain control over Germany. How did you go about kind of tackling this question and sorting out whether this was true or not, Veronica?
Yeah, I came across an essay written by Hans Mommsen in Aspects of the Third Reich, which is edited by a gentleman named H.W. Koch. And Mommsen basically went through point by point Tobias's assessment of the Reichstag fire and how neither the communists nor the National Socialists were responsible, and yet it was politically expedient at the time for each of those parties to blame the other. Now, I believe it was 20 minutes before the fire started, there were communists who had met in the Reichstag. So, you know, in the National Socialist mind, as kind of hyped up on their own propaganda as they were against communism, they immediately suspected the communists, and they ordered these kind of crazy, rash orders like shoot to kill, immediate arrest of all KPD and SPD. Those were the socialists and the communists. All of their party members, don't ask questions, just arrest. Goering was trying to mobilize the police, which he did not yet have control of. So this, of course, is one aspect where if you're going to orchestrate a false flag, you better have complete control of your police force first, because some of the police were like, we're not just going to arrest anybody on suspicion of starting a fire when we don't know this. How can you indict an entire political party? This is madness. So, and then at the same time, because there was a tunnel that went to the Reichstag, the communists said, oh, no, it was a National Socialist. You see, they used that secret tunnel. It had to have been Goering. He knew about it and all this. So, you know, ultimately, the story that we have of the National Socialists being responsible is straight from Soviet propaganda. I believe it's called the Brown Book of Nazi Terror or something like that. And it was put out by the Communists International as well as in Germany. And I went through all that, and they don't have any, their case completely collapses. And of course, Fritz Tobias in his Reichstag Fire book, he debunks the whole entire thing piece by piece and does a beautiful treatment of it. And of course, the arson, Marinus van der Lubbe, the reason he did it is because he was dissatisfied with how the communists were doing things. He's like, what happened to the communist revolution? What happened to us taking care of these fascist swine? I'm going to act on my own. I'm sick and tired of being the used and abused worker. And this individual was quite intelligent, and he made his way to Germany of his own accord completely. No money, no real means. And he had set a number of fires that day, and it was only by chance that the previous fires to the Reichstag were caught and put out immediately. And it wasn't until much later during the trial that those fires were connected to the same individual, Marinus van der Lubbe. And of course, at the trial, Goering bumbled so badly, and Goebbels even says this, that the Nazis lost the trial. So if you're going to have a false flag and you're going to orchestrate an event, wouldn't you want to have planted evidence, kind of a trial ready to go to? You want to have, you know, your talking points down. No, Goering made basically a fool of himself. And the other point is the South edition of the Völkischer Beobachter, the South German edition, went out before the Reichstag fire could be written about. So Goebbels is like, stop the presses, stop the presses. We've got to capitalize on this. It's got to be the communists. So before he was actually able to do that, that edition had already gone out without a mention about it. So again, if the Nazis were responsible, it just doesn't make any sense. Why would they bungle so badly unless they really were idiots, incompetent fools?
Van der Lubbe, he was Dutch, I believe, right?
Yes.
Yeah,
he had made his way to Germany, and he was determined to get the whole communist revolution started. And the other thing is the Nazis said, well, his language during his interrogation matched the language that, you know, the communists had been using up to that point. You know, we're going to have this strike and all this stuff. And they're like, it has to be connected somehow. This has got to be one of their stooges. And of course, they could never prove it. So, of course, the communists got off the hook and looked good, and the Nazis looked like bungling fools.
But they certainly decided to take the fire as an opportunity to kind of win and rally support behind them, correct?
Exactly, and that's where it looks suspicious. Hitler and Goebbels were very, very good at capitalizing on things, on politicizing certain events, such as the assassination of Vom Rath, which was another incident that occurred. So instead of seeing it as, oh, the Nazis were behind a false flag, no, these were very talented propagandists who understood how to make an event work in their favor.
Very interesting. Now, I think there's one fundamental issue here as well, which is that people still, you have a lot of information about this, Veronica, and the rank and file person out there doesn't, you know, look at this kind of stuff. They don't analyze the background, what was the political environment like at the time. There's a lot of nuances and variables here. But the fundamental point here and the fundamental line is that it was already a kind of conditions of warfare within the country between the political factions that was occurring at the time. And that's something I feel a lot of people are missing out on. They don't realize the intensity of the political and ideological struggles that were happening before even the National Socialists got in control and took over, you know, power in the country. Is there anything you can say about that in terms of, you know, how they were trying to a certain degree, you know, defend themselves and their own country from what they saw as an assault on their very way of life with encroaching communism and all that?
Oh, exactly. I mean, Germans had witnessed acts of communist terror and murder, which fed the fire of this widespread anti-communist paranoia at the time. Tula Society members had lined up in a schoolyard and shot one by one women, just assassinated outright. And then, of course, there was Weimar terror generally, where communists and national socialists were literally shooting each other in the street. And, of course, this was also the Stahlhelm. That's the name of the organization. They weren't national socialists, but that was another paramilitary organization that preceded basically the SS stormtroopers and whatnot. And they were killing and battling with communists in the street. Police had discovered mass weapons caches and violent propaganda materials in communist headquarters, etc. And then those were confiscated by the police and reported to the public. So all of this kind of feeds into the whole paranoia of the time period. This was the context. Nobody knew day to day what was going to happen. And of course, Hitler and Goering had personally witnessed the near takeover of Bavaria by the communists. And so this was still red hot in their minds. And they're like, oh, no, that is not going to happen. And Hitler was especially upset at the timing of the fire because the elections were about to happen. And he's like, there is no way these communists are going to shoot my chance, my final chance to get in there right now. The timing could not have been worse. So this whole idea of a false flag doesn't make any sense. Hitler did not want those elections postponed for anything in the world. It was crucial that they be on time. And it was Hitler who told Blomberg there cannot be martial law. That cannot happen because then the elections would have been postponed and he may not have gotten in there. I mean, they were at the peak of their good propaganda at that time. They were at the peak of their popularity. So again, that was the context.
In your view, was the paranoia justified? I mean, this intense, fear and, of course, blaming each other for every problem that was occurring at the time. Were they right in holding the suspicious view of the communists?
It's difficult to say because, you know, we weren't there. But I think given the reaction of Goering, Hitler, Goebbels, etc., the general feeling amongst nationalists, conservatives, Catholics, etc. in Germany, which were by far the majority, the communists were in the minority, I would say it was justified, yes. And especially given what was going on in the Soviet Union and what had gone down there. And we must recall that Hitler was in touch with white Russian emigres who actually participated in the founding of the NSDAP. They were actively involved. And they had told him a lot about what went down in Russia, and it was a bloodbath. So, of course, the Germans were like, that is just not going to happen here. And there were previous incidents where the Germans and the Russians had been working together militarily to kind of bypass the Versailles Treaty. And during that cooperation shortly before Hitler came into office, and he's the one that canceled it. He said, no more of this. There were Soviet ships docked in Germany that were full of paraphernalia and weapons. That was basically going out to their communist agents in Germany. And this was, I believe, 1931 or 32 when that happened. And Breaker McCoy wrote about this in, I believe his ebook is Secret Wehrmacht in Russia. That's the one that is from. And his site is quickmaneuvers.com. So he has all of that detailed. And he really does a good job explaining how frightening communism was for Germany at that time.
Quickmaneuvers.com. Check that out later. Now, how much do you think that they did know? I mean, this is what you explained a little bit already, but in terms of the communist atrocities in Soviet Russia, etc., I've heard this disputed from other sources. It's like we have a continuation of this war to a certain extent even today, but that they've said, well, this wasn't known until many years later. But if there were, as you say, actually people fleeing the area, fleeing the Soviet Union at the time, coming into Europe, it would make sense that people would know about this. How do you think that kind of spread to the upper echelons of the National Socialist Party? Did they talk with people who came? Did they kind of admit them in, try to take care of them? Or do you know anything about that?
Oh, yeah. Alfred Rosenberg was in extremely intimate touch with many of these white Russian emigres. He himself was, they called him the Balt. He was a Baltic German. So he knew all about what was happening to the Slavs. And this was written in a, I believe the name of the newspaper was Auf Gut Deutsch. And the editor was Dietrich Eckert. And he was an early teacher, if you will, of Adolf Hitler. And he played an integral role in developing the NSDAP. I call him one of the founding fathers of National Socialism. And he knew about this. He had a conversation with Adolf Hitler that he was basing a book on before he passed, before his time, of course, untimely death. But it's called Bolshevism from Moses to Lenin, A Dialogue Between Adolf Hitler and Me. And they talk all about this stuff, so it was known. And, of course, Hitler mentions it in Mein Kampf. How did he know about the millions of people being purged by the communist leadership if it wasn't common knowledge, and how would he put it in Mein Kampf in the early 1920s?
Yep.
So they did know, absolutely. And the white Russians may have exaggerated a bit, but they were heavily persecuted. And, of course, they had stories about how the Americans and the British were in on the side of the white Russians against the Reds before the Allies turned, and they became the allies of the Bolsheviks. So America and Britain were in there fighting, too, against the Bolsheviks with the white Russians before, you know, all this other stuff went down, before, you know, Hitler came onto the scene. And the white Russians knew about that collaboration as well. They were working directly with the Western powers.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, a lot of the theaters that the White Army was in was, 20s and, obviously earlier from that, from 1917 and onwards, really. But I forget when they were purged, you're right. That's interesting. Let me ask you about the funding here then a little bit too as we move along here. The idea that Hitler and the Nazis were financed by international bankers, be them Rothschilds or Rockefellers or Warburgs. There's a tie in here, of course, that in the conspiracy field that, it was really Jewish bankers that funded the Nazis. Ergo, there's a whole reasoning to be suspicious of everything that occurred at that time. You've written about this in the Demystification of the Birth and Funding of the NSDAP. Can you summarize that a little bit for us?
Yeah, basically, most people try to resort to this Hitler's secret backers, Sidney Warburg, an individual who never existed. And because the publication was pulled from the shelves, allegedly, everyone goes, well, that means it's real. Well, not necessarily. It could just be because it was such an outrageous lie. And because it was basically defamation of the Warburg family, they're like, that needs to be pulled. And then the other thing is there is no direct tie that anyone can make besides that fictitious character with the Jewish banking to Hitler or, the National Socialists. Now, I have heard the argument that Hjalmar Schacht is the direct connection. And yes, he was basically a Rothschild agent, if you will. He was best friends with Montague Norman, who was the manager, I can't remember his actual title, of the Bank of England. But Montague Norman hated Jews, loved German culture and Germans, and because he was so enthralled with the NSDAP, he was willing to lend money to the German government via Hjalmar Schacht for the sake of getting Germany back on her feet. He hated France as well. So part of the whole initial lending to the German government was largely Montague Norman personally, but then also England wanted to make sure that France didn't get too powerful, didn't get too much control over Germany or too much of an upper hand, because Britain has always been about balance of power. They wanted to make sure no single state got too much power over another so that they were always on the top. So that certainly played a role. And again, there's no direct tie. I know, is it Hutton,
Anthony Sutton, yeah.
Okay, Anthony Sutton says there's all these connections. Like, well, you need to look at General Motors and Ford Motor Company. Those all came in after the fact, after Hitler was already in power. There is no proof whatsoever, and he doesn't offer any in his book that I can see. I read the whole thing, where you see Standard Oil actually funding Hitler or transferring funds directly to Hitler. And, of course, Hitler prints his own money once he's in power. And that was the initial Reichsmark. And he had two programs put into place, which are actually documented by a Jewish author named Dan Silverman in Hitler's Economy. It's the Reinhardt program and the Zofort program. I think it's the Zofort program. Those two programs were all about work creation. And so these were two plans where we're just going to print a bunch of money. So, yes, it was fiat currency like we have now. We're going to go into serious debt to get ourselves back on our feet.
Yeah.
And then we'll worry about that debt later. Why would Hitler have to do that if he was funded by these magical Jewish financiers? And then one other thing, Detterding, Henry Detterding, who married a German woman, a National Socialist, in fact, was very pro-German, didn't like Jews, and wanted his oil fields back, which had been seized by the Soviets. He funded the Germans. He funded Hitler. It, to the tune of, I believe it was between 33 and 55 million pounds sterling. There were the Ruhr industrialists who gave Hitler money. There was the Völkischer Beobachter, which always brought in money. And there's just a number of other things in that essay where, you know, Hitler needed to basically, he ended up giving away everything to the party at one point, giving away, here we go, right here. Hitler was so financially strapped thanks to intrigue against him, and this was the von Papen clique, etc., that he ended up signing contracts amounting to giving away everything the party owned to finance his 32 election. Why would he have to do that if Warburg and Rothschild et al. Were behind him?
Right.
And again, that Bank of England money did not come through until Hitler was actually in 33. So there was nothing prior to that.
Right, right. Well, I've always wondered about the perception at the time as well, of course, of what was occurring, because the accusations of the crimes that people today charge against the Nazis was not in place at this time. So, I mean, it would make perfectly sense that there would be industrialists and whatnot that would want to trade and do business with Germany and Germans. And, you know, the party is, you know, first of all, not the entire country, but furthermore, they were heavily admired around the world at the time because of what they managed to do and turn around the economy in the country. So this kind of like, placing it all together in hindsight and trying to figure out is kind of like people look at, you know, a photo of Hitler shaking hands with another statesman, and then it's like, that's enough for some people to kind of accuse that they're all in on it. It was like, come on, this is a politician at the time. He was highly admired. He had things to, you know, to he ended up on the cover of Time magazine and all these kinds of things, right? So it's a very very simplistic and simple view that most people unfortunately have about this, I think, you know?
Right, right. And I mean, the maneuverings of Franz von Papen and Baron Kurt von Schröder, and he is not to be confused with Schroeder. Those were two different people, two different banks. And a lot of people confound the two. They'll say, oh yeah, Schroeder Bank in England, Rothschild. No, Schröder was J.H. Stein. So it was not the same bank, not the same person. So it was those two with a syndicate of investors, which included heavy industrialists, the Hamburg America steamship line, and that's where the Bush connection allegedly comes in, which is total nonsense. The Stein Bank of Cologne, Commerz und Privatbank, the Gelsenkirchen Mine Company, Deutsche Bank, Reichskreditgesellschaft Bank, Allianz Insurance, members of the potash industry, the Braybog Coal Company, Deutsches Erde, and a number of other brown coal industrialists. So that is really the conglomeration that came together. And Hitler's economic advisor, I believe it was Walter Funk, met with Schröder of J.H. Stein in Cologne, and he convinced him that Hitler was trustworthy. This guy will keep those communists out. He'll make sure that, you know, banking and everything is fine and you'll be fine. One has to play ball to an extent, especially in the beginning. You don't make everyone mad and say, you know, there's going to be a complete socialization and we're going to take all the bankers' money and give it to the masses before you're in there, unless you're a moron. So you play ball, and then once you're in there, you slowly implement these things so that the industrialists and the bankers don't balk, because they do not want redistribution. And that is, in fact, what Hitler had in mind. And it comes through later on in the tax code, etc. You see that there was socialist redistribution going on.
Well, I find it interesting that a lot of these ideas have kind of gone from fringe on the alternative, really, into more or less mainstream in terms of the Bush-Nazi link and the confirmation allegedly of that, right? Primarily right. Prescott Bush and all that. But, I mean, it's been The Guardian and the New Hampshire Gazette and a number of the other of these papers have posted on this, kind of following the trail here. Why do you think that this has caught on in the way it has? How is this serving any agenda today? I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Well, I think that what, you know, people that make that connection are trying to show how the American government is evil and it's going to plot and plan genocide against its enemies, which most of these people say it's modern-day Jewish Bolsheviks and their allies. Their Anglo-Saxon allies in particular, seeing as how they're most powerful in the Anglo-Saxon nations, that just like how Hitler did see these connections, somehow that ideology is also in the current government. It was in the Bush administration. It's in the Obama administration. And yet we don't see any proof of this. First of all, Bush never confiscated guns. There was no major gun control roundup, etc. There was no genocide. There were no FEMA camps for anyone under Bush. And everyone screamed that that was going to happen tomorrow, basically. And the same thing, there's nothing has happened under Obama. It doesn't mean that some freedoms, et cetera, won't be taken away if something does happen. But so far, we haven't seen it. So show me the evidence here. And basically, like the Jews themselves, these people are citing the Nazis as worse than Satan. That is the epitome of evil against which everything else must be compared. And so what I do is I undermine that image of evilness because it does not exist. They were a government like any other government. In fact, they had many attributes that were far more positive than Britain had at the time, that France had at the time, or that America had at the time. So we need to be objective about this and rational. These people are just being irrational. Just because one of the Bushes sat on the board of the America-Hamburg steamship line does not mean that he funded Hitler. He was just a board member. He was an investor. He was making money, a typical elite businessman. It doesn't mean he believed in what Hitler was doing. So this is where they're just exaggerating.
Interesting. You know, it kind of leaves you with this idea that, you know, the Nazis are alive and well today, right? That they're kind of secretly controlling America and also the European Union. There's been a number of these reports and hints coming out, but it's kind of like it's still, in my view, kind of missing the elephant in the room. It's lifting every rock to find every small little trace to see where they're at, kind of thing, instead of looking at, you know, who's running the show today and how things are going. And if they, I mean, all people have to do, really, I think, in that question is, okay, well, if that's true, how are the objectives of the Nazis being fulfilled in what we see in the world today, right? How is any of the, even if those, I guess, rumors are true or not, we can get into that a little bit later in terms of, you know, how they viewed certain things and whatnot. But nonetheless, it doesn't make sense to me because we're seeing a complete contradiction to some of the things they were trying to achieve, correct?
Exactly. And of course, I completely debunk Jim Mars's Rise of the Fourth Reich, which I read his whole book. It's well written. It's like maybe 80% factual, and then the other 30% is just complete nonsense and speculation and assumption and outright gibberish. I mean, this man actually resorts to the supernatural to explain some things, which, you know, if you can indict, invoke the divine, right? This is the kind of madness that's passing as a New York Times bestseller. And, of course, he's saying that the Nazis have literally implemented via America a Fourth Reich. And his only connection is the kidnapped scientists who were utilized by the CIA for various research projects, as well as those who were kidnapped to basically start our space program that we couldn't do on our own. Wernher von Braun, for instance, with NASA. So there is no connection. These people were kidnapped, and it was literally, do you want to live? Do you want to go to the IMT and perhaps suffer the hangman? Or do you want to come work with us, the victors? Your choice, Nazi. This is what we need to understand. A lot of these people had to run and hide the rest of their lives to get away from the Allies. Some of them sold out. Examples would be those who came to work for the CIA or NASA and simply did technical work. But, I mean, they try to act like these people somehow got into high levels of government and influenced the whole country to go to war. No, America has always been in a state of war at one time or another. And this is fully documented by a diehard neocon, Max Boot, in his excellent book, The Savage Wars of Peace. Literally, one year after another, the United States' perpetual warfare.
Yeah.
Well, the Nazis didn't make us, quote-unquote, aggressive and warring. We've always done this.
Right, right. Yeah, they stand on their own. Well, we don't have to linger on this point for too long, but there's another, you know, kind of report on this called the Red House Report with specific focus on Europe. I think the technical title is EW-PA-128 that alleges that there is a kind of a, it was a secret report that showed how the Nazis were basically, through financiers and through the underground business world, tried to kind of take over and run the European Union, which I have still very difficulty actually going to the real sources for it. I still haven't actually found a complete, you know, printout of the report. I haven't found too much else on the author, Adam Libor. The only thing that goes back is to a Daily Mail article back in 2009. Have you seen any of this? Have you looked into any of those claims?
I have not actually looked at that report, but I did see a reference to it in Adam Libor's book. And by the way, he is a Jew. He's Jewish and a fanatical Holocaust believer who wants reparations from Switzerland. Basically, his case is against the BIS or the Bank of International Settlements. But what we must understand about the BIS is they didn't care who they were working for. It was an international, basically sovereign entity that guaranteed the financing and the anonymity of financing for all nations. So it wasn't just the Nazis that took advantage of it. And of course, Switzerland kept hush-hush about all the help they were giving the NSDAP in monetary exchange, in placing their gold with Swiss banks, etc. So his book is Hitler's Secret Bankers, The Myth of Swiss Neutrality in World War II. It's a very good book. It's got some lies, you know, the typical Holocaust propaganda. But otherwise, I highly recommend it. It's a very good book. And what he ends up doing is exonerating the BIS and really indicting the Allies for being lying, mendacious, thieving scumbags in a way, that they were willing to turn a blind eye to everything the NSDAP was doing via the BIS. There were even Nazi officials in the BIS working directly with Americans, Brits, etc. So the Allies were willing to send their sons and daughters to die against the Nazi regime while they're letting these people put their gold in banks, etc., in Swiss banks. They knew all about it. And then the Allies ended up stealing all that gold at the end of the war and didn't say a thing about it. That gold, a lot of it, belonged to Czechoslovakia and other banks that had been, quote-unquote, looted to fund the German war machine. And that's a little bit, I'm being a little bit harsh on the Germans there, because actually when you annex a country or you absorb another nation, it isn't de facto theft. It now belongs to the occupying nation, just like Iraq's gold belongs to the United States once it takes over the country. So it's not outright thievery. It's a little more complicated than that. And of course, the Germans had allies in Czechoslovakia, and they did a lot of improvements there. But that gold was stolen by the United States of America and Great Britain at the end of that war, and they have never come clean on that. They have never given that back. And they decided, well, we don't know where this gold is from. They knew exactly where it was from. And here's one other thing. Morgenthau screamed and railed against the BIS, and this is in Labor's book. How dare you let these Nazis in there? I demand justice. These people are genociding us Jews and all this stuff. And the BIS basically told him off. They didn't care what he had to say. Well, so isn't this interesting that they told Morgenthau where to go?
Right, yeah. Huh. Well, that's a very interesting point regarding Adam Labor there, too. Obviously, he has, well, most do, I guess, but he has an axe to grind there, and that changes quite a bit in terms of that. And it's a really continuation of the monetary question here, too, of continuing to put blame on other European nations to kind of critique them into submission. I mean, we do see a lot of that. And by the way, I just want to mention as well, I understand that the audience want me to ask you about your views on, the camps and, all these kinds of questions that on what your view on this is. But for this program, at least, I wanted to focus on some of the other points, because that end up kind of stealing the show a bit. And it takes so much time to talk about that. So we can see if we can return to that another time or whatnot. So we won't be talking about that in this case. But there's many other issues around this that I feel are important as well. And one of them is the, what should we call it? The racial obsession with the National Socialists. And if we can talk about that a little bit, if there's a lot of rumors here, of course, in some of the other documentaries out there that are really good, talking about that were really, non-Aryan, non-white volunteers, for example. There were, black Nazis, there were, different ethnicities and the SS, whatnot. Now, if that's the case, what is the confusion here about, because people believe that, there was an extreme racial purity within the Nazis, and this was what they held up to any standard, and they refused to work with anybody else. In fact, they wanted to kill everyone else. Can you talk about this a little bit?
Yeah, basically that's just a complete lie. Right now I'm writing a book that really just centers on this whole thing. It's the next book in the Warwolf series. It's literally Black Wolf, White Reich, subtitle Black Nazis. And it goes along with my previous book, Black Nazis. Now, there was an article in Ken magazine, I believe the date was 1939, which is literally headlined Black Nazis. And it was an American publication. The Allies were denigrating the blacks that were working with the Nazis. And if you read the article closely, basically it's the American editor or writer of this article who's saying, these blacks are really dumb. They have no idea that they're just, basically helping this whole Aryan supremacy credo and this genocidal, maniacal Nazism to take over the world. So they're dupes. And then number two, the article is denigrating the fact that the Germans were willing to count the octoroons, quadroons, etc. That's how they're described in the article, as members of the NSDAP or as included in the German population figure, because basically the Germans were still interested in their Mittelafrika empire that they wanted to recreate from their lost colonies. And so they wanted to count those mixed race black white people as Germans because it bolstered the population claim to the previous colonies they had lost. So what we see is that the Nazis were practicalists. Yes, there were fanatical racists in the party, just like there were fanatical racists in Britain and America. There was one British official, I believe it was the Prince of Wales, who hated blacks so much that he got physically repulsed even looking at a black person in the flesh and could not speak to one because he was just so disgusted with their mere appearance and smell, etc.
Yes.
This is the kind of insanity we never hear about amongst the British elite.
Right.
Now, Hitler himself sat down and met with Dr. S.J. Wright, and this was written about in Ebony magazine, and he spent 4 hours with Hitler. Hitler kind of talked to him about his education at Heidelberg, etc., gave him an autographed picture of himself, shook his hand and told Dr. Wright, next time you come to Munich, stop by. We'll have another chat. So Hitler did meet with an African man, an African American, and this is only written about in Ebony magazine. I tried to get a copy, but lo and behold, I was unable to get one. But so the whole he wouldn't shake hands with Jesse Owens is just a complete myth. And, of course, that's been debunked as well by an author named Jeremy Schopp. I believe that's his name. And then if you look at the sheer numbers of the foreigners and racial, quote-unquote, minorities that were in the German armed forces, it numbers up to 3 million if you include the Volksdeutsch. And those were basically just considered German. Now, the fact of the matter is a lot of those people were not, in fact, German. They were Slavic or other mixtures. Because they wanted to be in with the, you know, the incoming occupier, they said, oh, yeah, all of a sudden I have a German grandfather or whatever. And so they would make their case. And this was especially the case in Poland and Czechoslovakia. So what ended up happening is you had a lot of Slavs who were basically classed as Volksdeutsch. And I think they had classes 1 through 4, and that was Himmler's idea. Okay, this will be class 1, which is like the most German, and then class 4 would be like the least German. And that could be somebody who was, say, Polish mother, spoke Polish, and identified with Polish culture, etc., but was willing to serve in the German armed forces and learn German and become German. So these people were willing to acculturate and assimilate. And then you see the same case with the Slavic Sorbs who were in Germany. Himmler and Hitler wanted to acculturate and assimilate those people. And, of course, they called them German Vents. They said these are not, in fact, Slavs or Germans. Now, of course, we'd have to do DNA tests on these people to find out if that's really the case. But there were a lot of Third Reich theorists that said, no, they are actually Slavic who simply kept most of their Slavic identity and their culture, and they just happened to be in Germany. But if you want to Germanize them, so be it. So there's a lot of gray lines that I guess a lot of Nordicists today and fans of Hitler, etc., don't want to hear about and don't want to accept, because what it does is it breaks down the view they have that Hitler was the champion of the white race and that it was Hitler who really was interested in kind of saving the whole white Western world from, I guess, darkness and this impending collapse that some authors of the time had written about, basically the eclipse of the West. But if you look closely at NS racial theory and the theoreticians, they proved that race was a synthesis of culture, language, sociology, and biology. And it comes through in a book written by a guy named Christopher Hutton, Race and the Third Reich. It's outstanding.
Very interesting. Well, I mean, the big question here is what is the truth? That's what we're after here. What really happened and what was the reasoning behind it? Because I feel that there's a lot of, there's a kind of a Hollywood, you know, version of this and an entertainment fabrication around this to you know, create a kind of a myth of that. And, of course, consequently, some people kind of pick up on that and kind of fulfill that, you know, stereotype of sorts, which is kind of, well, it's ironic and laughable, really, isn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, things were more complicated. For example, I just came across this gentleman contacted me Let me just find the name of this individual, because it was a guard at a camp, and it turns out he was half Aborigine. And when you look at his face, it's undeniable. And yet, if you and I were to just look at pictures of quote-unquote Nazi war criminals from IMT, we would not necessarily know that this guy was half Aboriginal. But let's see, his name is Otto Kulesa. Okay, so the Belzen guard, Otto Kulesa, K-U-L-E-S-S-A, was half Aboriginal. If one is to just look up that name, Otto Kulesa, on just Google search it, you'll see his very clear face shot, and it is undeniable, the Aboriginal features. He has kind of the flatter face, the wider nose. If you simply gave this man the dark skin of an Aboriginal, basically these modern-day Nordicists and Hitler fans would immediately reject him as basically a quote-unquote mud. But because he has that white skin and he was a Nazi and he did nothing wrong whatsoever, he was simply a guard at Belsen, he's a hero of the white race. Do we see just how changing someone's skin tone or even our perception of that person makes us hate them or embrace them? This is kind of why I'm having trouble with some of my detractors on the whole racial thing. And I mean, even the Nazi theorists themselves realized that the Nordic was already hybridized with the Alpine and the Falian race, and that there was no pure Nordic anymore. But also that the German people were a mixture of up to six different races. So this is something that they just don't want to hear. But, you know, even the Germans themselves realized it was a fact.
Yeah, so it's kind of a myth, and it's been, you know, again, it's just taken on a life of its own, really. And people, I mean, again, they project a lot of different things on this time and this history, because they want it to be in a certain way, be that, if, you know, from the most positive sense to the most negative sense. And, you know, as usual, I think that the truth is somewhere in between. It's you know, we can see, that's why I think it's so important to highlight some of these contradictions that we find within it, to see, to try to get closer to an honest picture of what really is going on. But, you know, it's a huge piece of you know, history here. It's so many intricate things that occurred and happened. Things we'll never be able to know, you know, thoughts on people, what they really, you know, believed or whatnot. But these things are certainly helps to put a different kind of slant on it in the very, very simplified version that we used to get through, you know, pop culture and everything else, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I thought it was really interesting what Hans F.K. Günther, he was a very prominent Nordicist who literally called the Germans a quote-unquote bastard folk. He said, you know, it's too late to save the German race from really this bastardization that took place, and it's nowhere near what it used to be as far as its puritanical Nordicness, but maybe we can somehow breed that Nordic back out, which is complete nonsense. I mean, you can't bring purity back out of a mixture, because the traits come through as individual whole parts when you combine any two people. So you could still be getting a Falian skull, you know, and maybe an Alpine body with a Nordic mentality. And do you call it Nordic just because it has the blonde hair and blue eyes that Mr. Gunter's looking for? So basically all he could hope for was like a superficial Nordicness to be brought back out from the German people. And pretty much all the theorists and even the Nazi officials themselves were like, that is nonsense. Okay, that we need to stop talking like that because you're offending an awful lot of Germans. But he wrote, this Gunter wrote, that the Jews, what they really shared, because they weren't a race, they weren't really a religion, they weren't really a culture per se, but what they had in common was a consciousness of shared blood. And this was expressed in a highly developed sense of separate identity. So basically what a lot of the theorists, perhaps even Günther a little bit himself, were trying to rekindle was that consciousness of shared blood in the German people. And the only element that was kind of idealized and, you know, really looked upon in a positive way by many peoples was that Nordicness. And so even if it wasn't factual genetically, biologically, what Hitler and other party members decided was that what we have in common, Germans, is our Nordic racial element. or our Nordic DNA, even if it's minuscule. Let's be united based on that consciousness of shared blood. Because Hitler was really running into trouble unifying the German people, despite the fact that they had a united nation.
Well, interesting. Well, I think a lot of this began as well in terms of, genocide of the Germanic tribes when, you had incoming Christianity, we had the Roman Empire. I mean, these are hundreds of years ago, if not thousands in some cases, in terms of the different wars and the factions and movements of populations that has occurred for many, 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 many times throughout our history. And that has certainly presented a more difficult, scenario than the more simplified people like to have today. But this is very interesting. I want to continue and talk more about this, Veronica, in the second segment. There's more of these kinds of, myths that I want to try to tackle and see what you have to say about them. But let's talk about your books a little bit and where people can find copies of these. I don't know how many you have. You can list them to us, Veronica. And I don't know, is there any one of these you'd recommend before another if they're newcomers to your work and want to try to, not get an overview perhaps, but one that is a little bit more encompassing? What do you think?
I would probably say Black Nazis 2. Now, the original Black Nazis is out of print, but Black Nazis 2 is the same book. It just has a long introduction added that addresses the arguments of my critics on Amazon and elsewhere who have challenged my thesis. And then it has like an added conclusion as well that kind of talks about the implications of my research and what it might mean to liberal democracy if we know the truth about the Germans and their multiracial, multi-ethnic army, et cetera, and all this collaboration. So I would say Black Nazis 2 is probably the best book to start with. And then if people want to know basically what Hitler and Himmler thought behind closed doors, top secret, not to be known or disseminated to the public, Hitler and Himmler Uncensored contains Himmler's Posen speech that has never been published. It isn't the Posen speech that's available online. It's a different one. It took place on the 24th of October for, I believe it was Freedom Day. And he really talks about the Russians, the Slavs, the Poles, etc., whether they can be assimilated and acculturated. Maybe I'm willing to do that. So you kind of see Himmler maybe backing off a tiny bit on his own extremism here. It really is a very good speech. And I think he had a lot of good points to say about the Slavs and their character, etc. And then, of course, Himmler's speech is to generals and officers in private in 1944. Some people have questioned this speech. It is very, very difficult to obtain, and it's very expensive from the IFZ, but it is a genuine speech. The authenticity was verified by a revisionist author in Germany, Ingrid Weckert. She's a document expert. So I know that there have been a couple people who have said, because I can't find this, it must not be an authentic speech. It is authentic, absolutely. So that would be the other one. And Hitler talks about race in a way that we have not heard him talk about race before. So this is the new aspect of his thinking. And he basically says, the way I thought about race before and the whole folkish idea was incorrect, and now I'm going to tell you the way we need to think from now on. So that's another fascinating one. And then I would say probably Truth for Germany. And that's an interview with MourningTheAncient.com. And basically, we dispel a lot of myths in a very quick, concise way in that book. And there's a full account of Ingrid Weckert's essay about Goebbels' innocence regarding Kristallnacht, which is another contentious topic for a lot of people that question Hitler. So she just blows away all the accusations against Goebbels there, and I translated that and put it in the book version. So that's in Truth for Germany, along with a lot of other stuff. For example, Stalin's offensive plan against Germany, which is documented fact.
Yep, exactly. Actually, one thing I want to ask you about a little bit later in terms of Poland and whatnot, what happened there. But we'll have the link up to the Amazon storefront, I guess we can call it, to where your books are listed. You also have Werewolves of the Iron Cross. I guess there's a couple of different versions of that one. Is that correct, or is it just different prints or something. Have you updated that? Maybe that's what's going on.
No, that's actually a series. So there's currently 7 books in the series.
Oh, there we go. That explains it.
Yeah, so The Werewolves of the Iron Cross, yeah, that's a series of various different books. And they all cover slightly different things. So The Hyenas of High Finance is basically about the Jewish banks and their shenanigans against Hitler, etc., what Hitler was really fighting and the NSDAP was really fighting, Jewish power. It's centered around 2 essays written by he wasn't really an ardent follower of the Nazis because he wanted to see more extreme action taken against the Jews. This was a man, his name was Dr. Heinrich Pudor, and he put out a series of these pamphlets, 2 of which were translated, and that's what the book is centered on. But he wanted to see pogroms against Jews, so he was what you'd call a quote-unquote violent anti-Semite. And the party just wasn't satisfying him in that respect, so he was calling for extremism. And then there's others like Albion and Zion United. This is actually going to be a 2-volume subset within the Werewolves series. And that talks about the creation or the development of the relationship between the Anglo-Saxon race, Albion, as it were, and the Jews, or Zion, and how those 2 entities together took over the world and they control it today. The Black Wolf, White Reich, an Afro-German family in Nazi Germany, that Werewolves book is about the Sabak El Sher family. They were mulattoes, and they did very well in Nazi Germany, contrary to myths about how we hear that mulattoes were all sterilized. And, you know, there weren't any mulattoes living in Hitler's Germany. There couldn't be any black people. Well, there were. And the family did relatively well. They did experience some discrimination and some suffering, but it was no worse than what happened in America or Britain at the time. So it's a really wonderful story with a lot of personal diary entry type information in there centered on that whole family. It was a father and his 2 sons really that were like in the Wehrmacht or in the Volkssturm, or, you know, the father was in the Imperial Army under the Kaiser, etc. And then I think that's it for the Werewolves books.
All right. Well, excellent. A lot of material there for people to dig into. We'll see if we get some time and ask a little bit more about Albion and Zion, kind of the British Israelite-ism, or however that actually is hyphenated. That we'll talk more about some of those aspects later, Veronica. But let's take a short break here. We'll pick up after that, and we'll be right back, folks. So stay with us. Well, as we start the second hour with Veronica Clark, we begin on the charge that fluoride was added in the water supply at the concentration camps to make the prisoners docile and obedient. We move on to talk about the alleged aggression by Germany against Poland. What really happened here? Was Poland an innocent lamb, or was there more to the situation that made it far more complicated than what we've been led to believe? We talk about the Versailles Treaty, the concept of Lebensraum, Hitler and Germany's alleged desire to take over the world. We discuss the ideological background to the war and communism versus nationalism. Further out, we discuss the Jewish Autonomous Oblast in Russia, and later we discuss the elite's planned demographic change in Europe. We also tie in Freemasonry into the picture again here. Very interesting how this connects to these kinds of plans, something that is so obvious that most people don't even think about it. We discuss the Judaic ideological connected roots to Freemasonry, and also, of course, why Hitler banned large activity in Germany, and how the agendas of this massive secret society plays right into the war and the agendas of today. Don't miss the second hour to hear more about Veronica's very interesting and challenging work that in some cases stand in direct opposition to the concoction that we've been fed and that most people accept without question. To learn more, go to redicemembers.com and sign up. A membership gets you full access to all our programs, videos, audios, and everything else that we have produced from 2006 and onwards. Tag along and support our efforts as we try to bring you the most interesting research that is both eye-opening, engaging, and challenging, with the purpose of making you question the established so-called truths, both of our history but also of our current times. Upcoming, we have Tom Sunick, Matthew Tate, John DeNugent, and also Tracy Twyman, Maurice 108, and Laird Scranton. For now, we say thank you for listening, but of course, if you want to join us for more, go to redicemembers.com and get aboard as we proceed with Veronica Clark in the second hour. We'll speak to you there.